Okay, well, hello everybody. I'll start with a quote just for Catherine. Okay. The search for a satisfactory definition of extraterritorial jurisdiction is doomed to failure. Extraterritorial jurisdiction, like bureaucratic, is a term that could never be rescued from its unattractive reputation. That's a quote by Andreas Löwenfeld, the famous NYU professor. I'm actually using it in an article where I argue, rather in Matthias's term, that extraterritoriality will not go away, and we should rather take a broad approach to extraterritoriality, but then start thinking about what are the actual, when is a connection close enough for a national court to take jurisdiction, regardless of what word we're using for it. Now, my subject is extraterritorial application of U.S. sanctions law, and what I want to do is, we've talked a lot about U.S. litigation today. It's rather a paper tiger, especially with Morrison and the civil litigation. And I just want to bring in maybe a little bit of a different view when we talk about U.S. sanctions law. And I want to start with a story that starts on January 1st, 2013, where a plane coming from Ghana, Accra, Ghana, landed in Istanbul Airport because of fog, and customs official found 3,000 pounds of gold in that plane. They were labeled mineral samples. And that was the beginning of what came to be known as the gold for gas scandal. It was also, one could say, the beginning of what we have seen happening in Turkey and where Turkey is today. So that find of gold had huge implications on policy and politics, actually. So what was the background? The background was the following. In 2012, when the U.S. started leading sanctions against Iran, they cut Iran off of the SWIFT transaction possibilities, so Iran was not able anymore to trade in U.S. dollars or euro. Now, Turkey had traditionally imported oil and gas from Iran, and the way they found to still do this, they said, well, we'll pay you in Turkish lira. Now, Iran had no use for Turkish lira. But they said, well, with the Turkish lira, we'll buy gold and we'll deliver gold. That was called by the Obama administration the golden loophole, which they closed only in 2013. And by that time, the Turkish businessman had delivered up to 8 or even 13 billion, it's contested, of gold to Iran by going to Turkey, going to Dubai, and in hand coffers, and then shipping the gold over the Persian Gulf to Iran. So Iran got lots of gold. Now, half of the gold trade controlled in Turkey was done by one man, and that man was called Reza Zarab. He was Iranian, Azeri Turkish businessman. He was married to a Turkish pop star. He had real estate. He has 6 yachts. He had a private jet plane. He was a very, very shiny person. And he was also the friend of President Erdogan of Turkey, and he had very close ties to the former Iranian president. Now, in order to keep that business going, and he was arrested then after the cargo plane incident, and the investigation found that there was extensive bribery up to the highest circle of the Turkish officials. There was a son of an interior minister. They found about $1 million of cash stashed away in shoeboxes. We had the CEO of the state-owned bank. They found $4.5 million stashed away in shoeboxes. We had the son of President Erdogan who was making calls to his father asking what he should do with the money. And that's when the schism started between Fethullah Gulen and President Erdogan, because Erdogan reacted and said this was all a conspiracy to oust him from office. And he started jailing and pursuing Turkish officials whom he assumed they were Gulenists. And in that process, Reza Zarab was exonerated in Turkey after all the officials were let gone and was freed. He later went to the United States. We don't really know why. I mean, he went to do vacation in Disney World and with his daughter and his then actress wife, and he was arrested, and he's been arrested there, charged for violating Iran-related U.S. sanction laws, and the bail has been so far denied. So there's other famous people in this case, one I've already mentioned, President Erdogan, who calls Zarab a philanthropist, who has been very busy also intervening in the United States for his liberation with the Obama administration, and very lately also with President Trump. So another. We have Preet. All the Swiss people know him because he indicted all the Swiss bank. Our friend Preet Bharara, he was the U.S. attorney who indicted Reza Zarab. He's accused by President Erdogan to have ties to the Gulen movement, not surprisingly. And he is no longer in office, as we all know. The last person in this mysterious case is Rudy Giuliani, a member of the Trump team. He has recently been hired by Reza Zarab to explore possible diplomatic solutions to the case. He has traveled to Turkey to discuss the matter with President Erdogan. He has also met with U.S. officials, and according to Rudy, at least, both sides are receptive to a diplomatic solution of the case, which means we may never know how this case would resolve if it went up. Let's talk very briefly about the Iran sanctions. What do we mean when we say Iran sanction? We mean 27 presidential decrees, 10 statutes, 5 administrative regulations. So it's a big piece of paperwork, actually. Most relevant for our case and most cases is the so-called IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, and also the ITSR, the Iranian Transaction and Sanctions Regulation. And this one especially, and here's the important provisions, which I've also put in the annex so you can read it, prohibits exportation from the U.S. of any goods, technology, or services to Iran. Exportation of services to Iran. That's what we need to remember from this case. Now, what did Preet and his office allege as facts? Now, they did not rely on the gold for gas scandal, probably because it was a res judicata. Also, we don't know exactly why. They focused on something else. They focused on roughly a dozen financial transactions from Zarab's money service businesses located in Turkey and the United Arab Emirates, meaning Dubai. And here are the trades. And we see a little bit, I put it on a map, where this all played. We have an Iranian bank going through Istanbul to make a payment to a Canadian entity. We have from the Iranian bank in Tehran through Dubai to a Chinese entity, to a Hong Kong entity. We have from Istanbul a trade or a payment going to Turkmenistan, which is, of course, a neighbor of Tehran, in U.S. dollars. And so what does this have to do here with New York, you may ask, if you look at the map? And this is what actually the defense states, and it's actually not even contradicted by the prosecution. That's what they say. They say Zarab stands accused for violating U.S. law for agreeing with foreign persons in foreign countries to direct foreign banks to send funds transfer from foreign companies to other foreign companies to other foreign banks for foreign companies. So not contested at all by the prosecution. But what the prosecution says, we've heard it several times today already well, but the currency used were U.S. dollars. And that is the only nexus in this case that we have. Now, what do we mean, and how is it that this would be enough? And I think, as a banking law professor, I need to explain a little bit about the clearing, how this works, why U.S. dollars nearly in 90% of the cases implicate some kind of connection to the U.S. And let me make this example. Even if I were to send a dollar payment to Andrea, who lives in Lausanne and I live in Bern, if it's in U.S. dollars, my bank will activate its U.S. dollar account with a U.S. correspondent bank, who will then transfer it to the U.S. bank that is sort of is the bank for his bank, and they will do the trading there. So there is a virtual. There's no question about this. We have a virtual connection, or this payment actually is cleared in the United States. There's very, very few exceptions where this is not the case. I've listed them there. You have certain clearing outside, but they're only for very small payments, and they're made because of time differences so that you can always clear U.S. dollars. Then it's possible if you're both with UBS that UBS would do it internally. But apart from that, all payments made in U.S. dollar will go through this this system. And so this is the jurisdictional link according to the prosecutions. Zareb exported a service from the U.S. which involved U.S. banks. Zareb caused U.S. banks to violate U.S. law, and Zareb caused effects in the U.S., and that provides us with domestic jurisdiction. And then the prosecution went on to say, and even if it were considered extraterritorial, economic sanctions are an exercise of the government's right to defend itself and to deal with foreign threats, and in these cases, the presumption against extraterritoriality does not apply, and sanctions law is precisely one of these fields of law where the presumption will not apply, and therefore we have extraterritorial jurisdiction because the sanctions want to be applied extraterritorially. Now, these arguments, they have been very, very successful in settlement cases. The biggest case was BNP Paribas in 2014, where we had Paris and Geneva trading with Tehran, Khartoum, and Havana. And they had the settlement of $8.9 billion in the U.S., also Preet's office, our friend Preet. And he's been similarly successful with Deutsche Bank, Credit Agricole, ING Bank, UK Standard Chartered. So it's been fairly accepted in settlement cases, but as we have heard, settlement cases never go all the way because we've heard this morning it's impossible for a bank to not to settle, or the incentive is very, very high not to settle and not to try to go to court. So what is the result? And Zareb is the first case where this has also been successful in court. The decision, Judge Berman in the Southern District of New York said, well, this regards the indictment only, and the dismissal of an indictment is an extraordinary remedy. Jurisdiction will presumably be an issue again at trial. So the reading of the case, but here I'm really not a proceduralist, says we're looking at this in a very preliminary matter. And I'm not throwing it out. That's at the end what Judge Berman said. He said, when foreign banks direct funds transfer through U.S. banks en route to other foreign banks, then this establishes sufficient nexus with the United States. And so this is within the statute. It is an exportation of services. And so we don't need to decide the extraterritoriality question. Now, the defense had argued, well, you can't really say that because it's like if you take a bus from New York to Florida and you go through South Carolina, North Carolina, South Carolina, whatever states, help me out. And so you don't say every time, well, you're coming from. You say you come from New York and you go to Florida, and what is en route is not an export or is not an originating from, it's going through. They have not been heard, so the judge said, no, this is enough, and it actually constitutes a service. And, again, even if jurisdiction were considered extraterritorial, this here is a special case because we have jurisdiction because it is Iran is a threat to the United States, so we have a U.S. interest in defending itself, so extraterritoriality will be granted. Now, what are the results, but what are also the problems with this reading of the law? The takeaway is that for U.S. courts to have jurisdiction, it is sufficient that the transaction is made in U.S. currency. We've seen this in civil litigation with PICTEC cases. We've seen it in FCPA cases, and now we see it in sanction cases. And so, but if you start thinking that 88% of all currency transactions are made in U.S. dollars, well, the the conclusion is that the United States have world jurisdiction on issues that regard their currency. And that is a fact. I think it's a policy question that we need to ask ourselves if that under international comity maybe is the right solution. Now I'm going to a place where neither Will nor Matthias want to go. I want to talk about international public law. I really do want to talk about international public law. And I realize that U.S. courts take a very unilateral approach. I realize that international customary law is something very old, but let's remember. And here, I think that, Matthias, we are not so much in disagreement. I would do what you do within an international law framework. I think it's flexible enough, but I think that jurisdiction, and especially in these cases, which we'll have more and more and more, jurisdiction is a key aspect of national sovereignty. And so if we start talking about regulating conduct or people or whatever outside, we need to look at the other countries. So it is a matter of international law. I've put in a citation of Kenneth Randall. But it's actually something that even in the U.S. at least finds general agreement with the Charming Betsy case that you have cited, an act of Congress never to be construed to violate the law of nations if any other possible construction remains. Now, if we look at these principles, we have the territoriality principle, we have the territorial effects principle, we have the personality principle. These are all accepted under international law. We have the protected principle, where a state can assert jurisdiction when its vital interests are concerned. And we have the universality principle, which actually Matthias has also mentioned several times, which is an accepted jurisdictional principle, although I have to say for very limited types of crimes. So again, I think we can expand into public international law to look at these matters. Now, if I were to apply public international law to the Reza Zarrab case, I would look at those principles which I think are implied. Now, the first principle is territoriality, payments passed through the U.S. That's the correspondent account jurisdiction. Now, the problem with this, I think, in international law is it's not really a substantial part of the conduct that actually happens in the United States. Even though we might argue, and that's something that sort of keeps going through my mind, you know, all in Switzerland, you have to when you use the highway, you have to buy a vignette. Huh? Even if you go from here just through Geneva again to France, and we all think that's perfectly logical because you pass Switzerland and you have a physical presence. Now, here, with money, you don't have that physical presence. But, of course, we could say, but physical is not what matters today. So we may look at non-physical presence with a more focused view and say, well, you can make that argument. Still, is it substantial? I think not. Then we have the effects jurisdiction. We say Zarrab caused the U.S. correspondent banks to violate U.S. law, and that's a domestic effect. But let's remember that even after the restatement that Will wrote, you need direct, substantial, and foreseeable domestic effects. And if we look at sanctions law, and if you look what happened, it's not a direct effect. It's only an indirect effect. You only cause the violation. You don't violate. Huh? Is it substantial? Well, it doesn't really overthrow the payment system in the United States. So it may be foreseeable, but really, under the effects doctrine, we would have trouble to create a jurisdictional link for the Zarrab case. Let's look at the protective principle. I think that's maybe the strongest argument of all. Iran is a threat to national security, so the U.S. has a right to defend itself. But, in what way? You could argue, and I think it's a valid argument to say, well, you have, of course, if it's transaction related to weapons or to other weapons of mass destruction or whatever terrorism sponsoring, then you would have that national threat. But for everything else, I'm not sure. But because let's remember, other states have not followed the sanctions. So obviously not everybody agrees that sanctions should go as far as the United States. So I think under international law, it's questionable whether the U.S. sanctions cases meet the threshold for a jurisdiction under international law. And that's where we may have a little disagreement. When I look at Morrison, and you say, well, it doesn't really, or international law doesn't pose any limit, I think this is a case where maybe we see limits that are not imposed by using the U.S. tests. And one thing that I find worrisome with Morrison is that it is totally unilateral. It looks and it says, where is my focus? And that is not in line with international law. Because whenever you have a domestic focus, it's domestic. And when you don't, then it's extraterritorial and you need a special justification for it, which is the intent of Congress. But that means whenever you put the focus, that's domestic. And I would say under an international law perspective, that is not only a path to jurisdictional overreach, that's a highway. That's a highway. So Morrison, from that perspective, Morrison is a worrisome development rather than a development that I could, from an international law perspective, espouse and say that that is really a new thing and we should follow that. So that was the question. U.S. litigation still a threat or a paper tiger? And let you give you my answer. As President Rand, inmate at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan since March 19, 2016. Thank you very much for your attention.